Given my experience working for Mr. Trump, I fear that if he loses the election in 2020, that there will never be a peaceful transition of power. And this is why I agreed to appear before you today.
Yes, it is Friday, March 1st, 2019. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out to Coop podcast. This is Kev Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Each week, I talk to our Capitol muckraker-in-chief, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. In today's show, it was the best frickin' mob movie I've seen in a long time. Michael Cohen testified before Congress, and it was a large popcorn bucket-worthy event. And like we've been saying for a couple of years now, the best way to understand the Trump administration is to read it as an organized crime story. And now, it looks like we're going to get the Trump's accountant, Alan Weisselberg, to testify after all. If you watch a good mob movie, you know you got to get the fixer and you got to get the accountant. Check, check. Cohen's closing statement, as you heard there in the intro, was warning that if Trump loses in 2020, he will not allow for a peaceful transfer of power. So nothing, something just to warm the heart on a cold, chilly day. Trump got Kim Jong-un in Vietnam. Pramila Jayapal drops a major Medicare for All bill that, wait for it, is better than the plan advocated for by Bernie Sanders. The bill was drafted with nurses, doctors, disability rights activists, advocates for the elderly, or organizations such as Public Citizen and the Center for Popular Democracy. One of the main groups that was authoring that was the Nurses Union. You betcha. This past Tuesday was a great day for Chicago socialists as four of the five DSA-endorsed candidates won their election to Chicago's city council. And at least two other progressives, they were not endorsed by DSA, but two other progressives were also ousted established Democratic Party machine candidates. Freaking huge. Washington Governor Jay Inslee enters the presidential race with an unabashed commitment to address climate crisis. He basically says, this is our last shot. That's why I'm running. CPAC, Conservative Political Action Conference, is underway outside D.C. All the tensions with Trump are nowhere to be found. Remember, CPAC used to claim, we don't like Trump. Oh, no, they're embracing him full on. MAGA hats everywhere. Oh, and it's been fun. And one of the kind of things that came out of that, a good old Tricky Ricky, Rick Santorum, right here from Pennsylvania, former ex-senator, he went CPAC, and guess what? He's calling for paid family leave and saying that conservatives should get on board. So if you have any question about whether the organizing, the left progressive organizing that's been going on has been moving the needle at all, look to Tricky Dicky. All the more reason we got to take control of that discourse, that's for sure, because you know what he's going to want. Paid family leave just for men and women who are married and are white, I'm sure. Senator Bob Casey says that he'll be backing a $15 an hour federal minimum wage, and it pretty much marks his continued political evolution, right? Stepping out of the bland backwaters into kind of like the edge of progressivism. How about that? And about 1,700 workers are on strike in Erie, Pennsylvania, as Wabtec, the new owners of the former GE locomotive plant, they basically have demanded up to 38% reduction in wages, mandatory overtime, expansion use of temps, and arbitrary scheduling. And Bernie Sanders even came and weighed in on this. In these Times reports that this is the biggest U.S. manufacturing strike in the Trump era. It's huge. Charter Appeals Board? Say what? What the hell's that? Imagine a state-controlled government panel that is specifically designed to overturn local school boards and favor charter schools. We didn't know where the Corbett people went. Now we know. Now we know. Big Pharma, big greed. Penn Live is a great profile of a PA woman who was basically used to be able to get free medication for a rare neuromuscular disease, but thanks to BioMarin Pharmaceutical, recently gained exclusive rights to sell the drug, she is now going to be forced to pay upwards of $375,000 per year just to get that necessary medication. So you want to know why that there's these hearings going on in Congress about kind of the problems and the greed of Big Pharma? Here's your case. Elections have consequences, everybody. And State Senator Vincent Hughes says he wants to take a data-driven approach to public policy to ensure that lawmakers are fully informed about the potential impacts of legislation on people living in poverty before they vote. Use that data to do things like, hey, you got this bill? Okay, we got to run it through this this process so we can see how's that actually going to impact, cost it out, how is it going to impact poor folks in the state? It'd be kind of interesting. And today's last call, SpaceX. Yes, tomorrow, set to test its first ever Crew Dragon spacecraft. If the weather continues to cooperate, I think it's got an 80% chance of being good weather. The Crew Dragon is designed to bring astronauts to the International Space Station. If all goes well, this will be the first crew-capable orbital spacecraft to launch from the U.S. soil since the Obama administration scrapped the space shuttle program in 2011 in favor of contracting out missions to the ISS. Yes, gotta love those public-private partnerships, don't you? Boeing, the other company, by the way, who's tapped by NASA to fly crewed missions to the ISS, well, has its own test launch set for April. And Canada becomes the first country to join up with NASA on its Lunar Gateway project. See, you all thought I was freaking a nut job for talking about all this stuff, that I was a blah, blah. But here you go. This is what is happening. The Lunar Orbital Platform Gateway program will be a human-tended facility in the orbit around the moon, kind of like a sister station to the ISS. There you go. Canada's on board. The Canada arm is going to be built for it. If you remember back in the space shuttle days, the Canada arm was the one that they used to basically launch off satellites from the space shuttle. I believe they've got one on the ISS, too, as well. And this Sunday, Free Rule Brewing will be celebrating the spirit of Mardi Gras with barrel-aged tap takeover in the main brewery in Perkasie. And we've got a double can release tomorrow. Fresh King Cake, a no-boil white ale brewed with 120 pounds of fresh ground pecans, orange, cinnamon, and vanilla. Pretty cool, 7% ABV. That's going to be at both locations. And they got right back in time for St. Paddy's Day, 7-course red. And that is the traditional Irish red ale. So, hey, everybody. You know, if you get a chance, tune in to the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this and every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern. Or you can stream the show live at freespeech.org. Go check out Rich's show on iTunes, Podbean, or wherever you get your podcasts for his daily show. And I want to remind everybody, if you want a progressive future, we need progressive media. You can help support Pull No Punches, homegrown progressive media today. Become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. Not ready to become a member? No problem. Just go to ragingchickenpress.org and click the big blue donate button in the right sidebar. The best way to invest and keep media in the movement in the media, is become a member for as little as $5 a month. patreon.com/rcpress today. Oh, man, happy snow. Did you guys get snow out there?
Yes, we did. We got some snow.
Yeah, my kids... What's that?
Might be getting more snow this weekend.
Yeah, or more crap. That's what it sounds like to me. It's like...
Out here, we're looking at like 10 to 15 inches.
Get the hell out of here. Are you serious?
So if you look at some of like the weather models, like the not looking on like the news sites.
Oh,
like,
let me guess. You're a European model guy.
Yeah, if you look at the Euro or the GFS and
yeah,
stuff like
it's
that,
actually a better model. Yeah.
It has like the storm tracking south and just hitting all of central Pennsylvania with another 10 to 15 inches.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's looking like. It can go either way, but it's looking like we might be getting like a foot of snow. And I have a friend on Facebook who has like his own weather predictions.
His own weather predictions?
Stuff, but he's always posting pictures of the models what they're saying. A lot of the models are in agreement that we're going to get hit like between 8 to 10, 10 to 15 inches.
Wow. Well,
so you might be getting a little bit more snow than anticipated.
Well, I don't know. It's interesting the way that the models go, depending on how the storm tracks, right? I mean, which is basically what you're saying, right? I mean, but it looks like there's been a difference between how the weather has been hitting you all out there and then where I'm at. Like, we just getting just a lot of garbage stuff. And meanwhile, my parents, right, they're up in Utica, New York. They've had like two back-to-back blizzards. That have come through, like, with, I forget how much snow they said, like about 15, 16 inches of snow. But, like, you know, blinding winds, whiteout conditions, you're kind of not be able to travel. And then the next day it gets sunny and hot, and then it gets blizzard the next day again. It's been nuts.
I remember we had that at Kutztown, like 2010. We had those two blizzards within, like, 2 weeks.
Yep. That was a good winter, actually. I like that winter.
Yeah.
That was my kind of winter.
It's been a weird winter.
It's the second one in a row. It's been like this is the way last year was, if you remember.
But it hasn't been like hot or warm at all this winter.
What are you talking about? It was like freaking 60 degrees on multiple occasions. Sunny. I was in shorts.
But also it's been consistently like in like the 40s, upper 30s and 40s the whole time. Where like we've at least got here in Harrisburg. I mean we've gotten some hot days.
In your microclimate?
Yes.
Because you're by the water.
But no, also like, I mean, we haven't, it seems like it's been consistent with the snow instead of just getting like one or two big snowstorms. Like we've been getting like a bunch of like 3 or 4 inches.
Yeah, we haven't. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it's not that far away, but it's been the way that the storm has been tracking. We've been getting more like sleet, freezing rain, like slush from the sky kind of stuff. You know, we're right at that border. It's just been weird. I mean, it wasn't that long ago, like you say, 2010, but I also remember several other kind of winters, even since I've lived in Pennsylvania, that have been, you've had much more like snow, like in January, right? In end of December, January, February, like beginning of February now. And, you know, this is consistent with climate models and they say that, you know, you're going to have the storms and stuff are going to be pushed later on in the season. So, but. Yeah, I could talk about weather all day. So,
at least within a couple weeks, within 10 days, we'll be springing forward our clocks again.
Yeah, well, we'll see.
Daylight savings.
Well, it's a good thing that we're going to get a real spring this year, especially since Trump is nominating climate deniers to head environmental protection stuff and a former coal lobbyist, too, which I didn't put in the kind of intro today.
But also, I heard like we'll have more veggies.
Yeah, well, photosynthesis, man. Photosynthesis. See, this is the thing they don't teach kids in school anymore, Sean. They don't teach kids in school anymore that plants suck up carbon to make oxygen. So actually, the climate change is actually beneficial because of the carbon, because it makes plants sort of synthesize better.
I think I want to put this like my brother on blast real quick.
Yeah.
My brother is Trump supporter, whatever, but. He's smart enough to where he runs his own business and he's like educated in math, like 4.0 GPA graduate in mathematics from his college. And even he is like making fun of the warnings that we have to change our like societal habits when it comes towards eating beef because of the amount of methane that is produced through like cows and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Like he thinks that like cow farts are a joke.
He thinks that's a joke.
Yeah, he thinks like, but it's just like he's falling into. He's falling into that right wing. Like we're just gonna like make fun of this obscure like fact of life that there's actual science behind.
Well,
but he thinks right. The methane, like the science behind the methane, is like it's a joke. Like it's something that like for conservatives to like laugh at that because they can't take it seriously.
That's crazy. I mean, look, the thing, you know, that's the first time I heard that too as well. I mean, the first time I heard that, I thought that was a joke. I thought like, oh, okay, blah, blah. I thought it was like the reverse. Like it was a conservative talking point to like, you know, just like belittle like the whole thing. Yeah, because the cows like fart more than blah, blah, blah. But then actually, you know, then looking at some of the science, right, looking at some of the studies of it, if you actually just fed – even if you just make the step of actually shifting cows to a grass diet, right, the amount of methane they produce drops kind of like enormously.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, even stuff like that, right? I'm like, holy crap that we actually have concentrated methane producing kind of like factories, but they're biological in nature. They're cows because of what we freaking feed them.
Yeah. And methane is worse than carbon dioxide.
Right. Right. It doesn't stay in the atmosphere as long, but it has like.
Well, yes,
like,
it does actually.
But it breaks down into something else, right?
It breaks down the CO2. So it spends 20 or 30 years. So like methane, it's a lot more reflective, has a higher like reflective it has a higher spectral curve than like carbon dioxide does.
Oh, good. So basically, it cools the planet. So we're good.
No, it's more efficient. It's four times more efficient than trapping greenhouse gases inside the atmosphere than CO2 is.
Right.
But like the methane only stays in the atmosphere for 20 years because of how weak the bonds are, right? But like they become carbon dioxide, which remains in the atmosphere for 200 years. So CH4, so all the hydrogen atoms.
CH4 is methane, right?
Yeah, it's methane. So all the hydrogen atoms break apart, and then the carbon's CO2. That carbon then has two oxygens that latch on, and become CO2.
Gotcha.
So then it stays in the atmosphere for another 200.
So it's basically, so the methane itself is not there for as long, but basically it's once it breaks down, it doesn't go away. Right?
Yeah, it breaks down into carbon dioxide.
I see. Oh man, crazy.
That's like why fracking is so bad, especially like methane, fugitive methane emissions. That's why we should, be against natural, because of all like the methane leakage. Yeah, right. It might be smaller concentrations, but enough is getting out there to where it's contributing to our carbon footprint.
Right.
And I can go on about the current administration, but.
Well, I was going to just barely even talk about this, but I think that I just want to just, put this on the radar, because I know it's probably just going to be a sidebar note for the election stuff. But, I mentioned this before, is that Jay Inslee, and I think everyone is perfectly fine in saying what Sean said when I said that. He's like, who's that? Because I think that was my response to Jay Inslee. He's the governor of Washington, the state of Washington, and he just basically announced his candidacy for presidency. And I don't even know if he thinks that he's got a real shot at even being, kind of one of the final contenders or not. But I think it's notable that basically let me read you what his statement, right? He basically says, quote, I'm Jay Inslee and I'm running for president because I'm the only candidate who will make defeating climate change our nation's number one priority. The 68-year-old governor. This is from the CNBC thing. A 68-year-old governor said in a video announcing his candidacy, quote, we're the first generation to feel the sting of climate change, and we're the last that can do something about it. Our country's next mission must be to rise up to the most urgent challenge of our time, defeating climate change. Right. And he actually wrote a book on this about 10 years ago called Apollo's Fire, which is now on my reading list because I want to kind of check this out. And he argued in that, this is 10 years ago, for a clean energy program on the scale of John F. Kennedy's moonshot. Right. So he's got some credentials to this. This is not just kind of coming out and just being like a trick. He's actually got some credentials and actually had been at this issue for a while. And I think I'm really, really hoping that he's going to meet his criteria to get into the debates, because I think that this has to be one of the key issues. And I think that if you got this guy coming in and arguing from this perspective, you've got the Green New Deal stuff that's on the that is on the table at this point. We need this. I mean, because we're at, 11 and a half years now till we have to address the issue.
Yep. TikTok.
TikTok, man. TikTok. Yeah. So that's not how we wanted to start today's podcast, but but there we go. So this week was, Sean, did you watch the hearings?
Yes, I did. And I watched like 5 of the 7 hours of the hearings. I thought I wasn't going to. And I just get sucked in from the beginning and just like, all right, I am not like leaving my vicinity. I had the hearings on. I wasn't watching them. I was just listening to them and getting shit done in my apartment.
Yeah.
But it was really good entertainment.
Oh my God. I sat there. It was like,
it was just like watching the Godfather saga.
It was beautiful. I was like, I tweeted out as I like, it's like, I tweeted this out. It's like, this is the best mob movie I've seen in a long time. Right. And I said, it makes me miss home, Utica, New York. Right? Cause, I mean, it's like, I grew up in a town that was, had a huge mob influence. And like, we've said on this program for ages now that this is how you got to understand the Trump administration, right? And, all like hat tip to Sarah Kendzior, who's been shouting this from the rooftops for years, way before Donald Trump ever kind of became a contender as a candidate. But basically saying this is what the background is, and you have to understand this. This is what this autocratic move is. I'd look at it as organized crime, right? And this is exactly how they operate. And like the Cohen was like, I'm telling you, it was freaking great when he's sitting there, like,
starts swinging.
Well, he's asking people, he's getting asked things like, well, how do you actually, you know, how do they do this? So you kind of like, you reduce your tax burden or something like this, right? And Cohen is like, without missing a beat, he's like, here's what you do. You take this asset, right, and you read, and like he runs them through. This is how people avoid taxes, right? I'm like, this is awesome. And he's like, and I guess I had to say, for me at least, one of the highlights of the entire hearing was when Cohen, and this is actually, I wanted to be able to pull some more sound for today, but I just didn't have time. But when Cohen basically says goes back at the it might have been Jim Jordan at that point. He said, what you're doing up here with your silly signs. And he's like, I get it, because I did that for 10 years. I was the guy who would take some article and out of context and use that to try to discredit something. That was my job, to fix those problems and defend Mr. Trump at all costs. And he's like, and that's what you guys are doing right now. And he's like, I'm responsible for what's happening right here and these silly signs that you guys are putting up there. But if you continue to follow the same path that I did, you will pay in the same way that I am. I'm like, go!
I loved, like, I was waiting for the daughter and like the wife to be like ushered into the crowd,
mm-hmm.
like from like the scene from Godfather when they brought the brother in from Sicily.
Yep.
Like,
gonna sit down in the room there.
Yeah, like a couple rows back.
A couple rows back, and you'll see Cohen look over his head and do a double take, right? And the camera would zoom in on her face, right? And it would have this like stone worriedness to them, like she knows she's gonna die if he doesn't do it.
I mean,
and then Cohen turns out and then says, like, yeah, I don't know nothing.
I watched the whole, I mean, I felt like the best part came from like Ro Khanna. Like the questioning that he has, mm-hmm. like, because like once like the lunch break happened, Ro, like, they interviewed him and he was just like, no, this is the smoking gun. And he told like the people, I'm going to use my 5 minutes to talk about this check. And right. I was like, I mean, like, they, I mean, like, him and AOC just got like, well, there goes Don Jr. Like, you just see the whole family going to jail. And it's like, it's predicated on this like willful ignorance. It was like, yeah, like Trump didn't tell me to lie, but it was implied that I lied to Congress about Russia.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
I mean, like, which is still a crime. That's still a felony.
Right.
Like, if you imply overtly, or like, it's willful ignorance. It's like you're still responsible for the actions of your underlings.
Right. What was awesome? I mean, like, Ro Khanna, his questioning was great. AOC's questioning was fantastic.
Matthew Calamari.
Yeah. Exactly. We call him the squid. Because you look at guy's face, man. He looks like a freaking squid. No wonder they call him Calamari, huh?
And this guy, like, did you read this stuff on Calamari, like his background?
Yeah.
Like, so he was reported on in 2017. And this dude's like a total just piece of shit, like, surprising, like, who beat the shit out of people. And was like, right. Another, like, who was the fucking, like, the person with the brass knuckles. Like, Cohen's the
exactly.
fixer. Calamari's the fucking enforcer.
Exactly.
Like, the fucking cop stash and, like, everything else.
And he looks like a 1970s, like porn extra, too, as well. You know what I mean? He's like, he looks like that, you know, that classic thing when you'd see, like, the guy with the curly hair and the shaved Foster Grants. Right? And they even got all these pictures that started, pictures from, like, in the Washington Post and blah, like that. And the guy looks like he's, like, you know, like putting his fist into his hand in all these pictures. He just can't help himself. He's like, I'm getting a little itchy. I think I need to beat someone. This is freaking crazy, man.
Yeah, like it's.
Yeah, so there was that, and I have to say, one of the cool things that, you know, you sent me that article from Splinter on AOC making a list, right? So, like, have you watched Game of Thrones yet?
I have not. No.
All right, so you don't know that reference, then, probably.
No.
All right, so let me, I'll give you a little spoiler, right? So Arya Stark is like a character in Game of Thrones, right? And, you know, her family basically, you know, they ruled the North and they kind of went on from there, blah, blah, blah. But then she basically wants revenge after his father is killed, right? So she basically wants revenge, and she goes out, she gets trained and all this kind of stuff. And she makes a list, and she rehearses this list in her head of all the people she's going to kill to pay back, right? So that's the first thing. When I saw you send me that from Splinter, I'm like, oh, I don't think Sean watches Game of Thrones. I don't know if he knows the reference here. And I don't know if that was a direct reference from them, but that's what I saw
she was making a list of people to start looking into.
Well, like, that was it. And what was brilliant about that, Rokana's and AOC's, like, one, I think people were expecting AOC to make some sort of like political grandstand in some ways, and she didn't. She went right for, okay, this is, it was kind of like, it was, yeah, it was kind of like, here's this is the hearing, everything's been said, I don't need to have a prepared statement that I got to show you what I think about this stuff. What I want to know is, I want to know what the next step is. So who do we need to talk to, where are these things, you know, where are the bodies buried, right? Who, and you know, Cohen just gives her the names, and then at the end you got, what's that?
Because Alan Weissenberg, Matthew Calamari, just like...
Yeah, exactly. That was freaking awesome. It was awesome. And then at the end, Elijah Cummins actually comes back and says, well, everyone who was named today is like, we're going to want to talk to. So, and I've been wondering, and I don't know, there's probably people out there who know more about this than I do and about why this is the case. But ever since that, like Alan Weisselberg, right, the, like Trump's like personal accountant that's been with them for, God, decades, ever since that... He's was brought in for questioning. Like, he's got, my understanding, he guy's got an immunity agreement, right? And so, and any kind of like organized crime thing, you know, you want the accountant, right? You want the accountant because the accountant knows where everything is and how the money. That's the key thing. It's not just that the money is there, but how it's covered over, right? And they know the process, not just the numbers, but they know how accounts are being used in order to make it look as if that there's no corruption or there's no money laundering and that kind of stuff going on. So, but we haven't heard anything about his testimony, very little about what's going on. And for me, this guy has got to be like a star witness. So I don't know if they're waiting. Well, either they've got all they need about him already and everything's quiet because, you know, Mueller and them are waiting to bring it in, or the Southern District of New York is waiting to the end, or they're actually waiting to bring in Weisselberg at the end to corroborate all the investigation stuff that they've already done. I don't know. But it's just fascinating the fact that this is the first time that he's been featured so predominantly when, in my mind, that's your no-brainer. That's the guy you want from the beginning. So it's been always a question for me is why we haven't heard of anything about his testimony. So
I also loved like the stuff like with people attacking him, you're going to get a book deal. He's like, well, he's like, you've been approached with book deals already. He's like, yeah, and TV and movie too.
Yeah, and I love that. I love what he's like, yeah, that's right. I'm going to get a movie. Like, who do you want to play you? what he says at the freaking Jordan, I think, right?
I mean, also like the what's like hilarious. It's like he's going to be in jail for the next like 3 to 5 years. He's going to be in a, you know, low minimum security, probably white collar prison. And he's going to be in there since, like, we don't prosecute white-collar criminals anymore. He's going to be in there with, like, violent drug offenders. So what's he going to do? Stick around outside of his cell all the time? Or is he going to be inside writing a book? He'll probably be writing a book. He has some time for getting those spare thoughts together.
Yeah, I mean, look, the fact of the matter is, we know how this country works, right? We know that kind of, like... Cohen is not going to be put like
book afterwards.
Yeah, he's not going to be, but he's also not going to be sent to Rikers Island and put in like, you know, in general population. I mean, that's not how these people ever go to jail. Even the ones that are freaking as crooked as he is, right? But this,
he'll have some free time, gather some thoughts, he'll have a computer.
Totally. And you know, and I wanted him to say this, but I know why you can't say this in there. But I would have loved to him to say, like, he said, you damn right, I'm going to write a book. And wait till that thing comes out. You think this is bad? Wait till that one comes out. Right? Right? You can start thinking right now about who you want to play in the movie because you're not going to come out looking so good. You know, I'm serious. Like, I want, like, you know, part, like, the visceral me wanted that. But obviously, if he said that, then he's, like, threatened a Congress member. And
I mean, I wish he would have said, yeah, of course I'm going to be writing a book.
Yeah, I mean, why? Of course.
Why wouldn't I?
One of the most, like, what could turn out to be? Well, first of all,
the shittiest human beings on the face of the planet right now, right behind Donald Trump and a couple of others. And
right, and you're talking about unprecedented guy who's got an unprecedented kind of like vision on the, like, probably the worst president in American freaking history. One that's kind of issued our whole country into some sort of freaking weird turning point where like insane criminal behavior is normal. All this kind of crap. Right. Of course you're going to write a freaking book. Right. Yeah. And if you don't write a book, you're stupid. Right. So, but you know, again, that just showed me that they had nothing. They, yeah. I mean, what are they going to do? I mean, what are they going to say? Well, we know that you did wrong. He's like, I already pled guilty at all. I'm going to jail for it. Well, I mean, you're not telling anybody anything new. Fucking, I kept waiting to also stand up like, you can't handle the truth.
That's such a good sound drop.
My God, I'm telling you, I was catching pieces of it, and I came back and watched it later, but I kept big chunks of it during, like, you know, when I wasn't teaching or when I wasn't meeting with students, but so I had these kind of periods of time which I could check in on it, and I was like, oh my God, I just wish I could just sit there on a widescreen TV and watch
this. We're watching the Cohen hearing for 45 minutes.
Oh my God, it's kicking me now that I didn't just take the day off and, like, you know, it's like it's good. This has got to be playing on an IMAX somewhere, right? Oh my God, that's been crazy. And I guess like the second part of it. So I mean, any other takeaways from the hearing?
I guess we can talk about the closing statements.
Yeah, that was pretty. That was something. That was something.
I think he's a fan of the podcast.
Yeah, I think so. I'm like, Michael Cohen's been listening to some Raging Chicken out the coop and has been reading up on Sarah Kendzior, I guess. I think that's a... talking about... I did not see that coming at all. What's that?
Yeah, that, like... I mean, I didn't see that part. I wasn't paying attention to that part when he said it. But, like, afterwards, seeing the reaction, people were just like, holy shit, he's not... He just said Trump's not going peacefully.
Right.
Which is pretty much what we've been saying for a while.
Well, that's exactly it. He says, you know, if he does not get reelected in 2020, he says he's not going to allow for a peaceful transfer of power. And that just I've got this video. I'm going to put it up on probably our Twitter feed, and I'll also post it on our Facebook page and things like this. But I just did a recording of some of the hearings. And there's that scene where he's saying this. There's this woman that's sitting behind Cohen. I'm sure somebody's already clipped this out there already. But there's a woman that's sitting behind Cohen. And she had exactly the response that I did, right? And I think a lot of people did. It's like, Cohen says this about, you know, is not going to allow for peaceful transfer of power. And she's kind of looking there and just coming out. And it's kind of like, you know, just like, I don't know, 2-3 seconds pass. And then it's like, it sinks in what he just said. And she's like, whoa. And just kind of like shocked by it. And I'm like, that was, yeah, let that one sit in. Let that one sit in.
Yeah.
Crazy, man.
You don't think the Republicans are going to take that to heart, though, do you?
Are you kidding me? I wanted to watch to see how it was, like, you know, getting covered later that night. I just shut off the freaking news because I was like, I can't listen to you people talk about this, because it's like, you know, maybe the Republicans will now. I'm like, really? Did you just see what they just did in there? I mean, if that's not the last straw,
a witch hunt. It's a witch hunt.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. I said, any hope?
Cohen bought the fucking receipts, showed them to Congress, like, here's the receipts right here. All can see. And I'm like, yeah, it's a witch hunt.
Yeah, but you get to see exactly what the deal is when, you know, you have that people like... oh God, what's his face? Meadows, right? Like Meadows, was elected. He's like the head of the Freedom Caucus, right? He's a guy who's like, when he was campaigning for office, was basically saying, yeah, we're going to send Obama back to Kenya, wherever he's from, right? Kind of like using all that birtherism crap, right? It's like, that's what's happened. That's where the Republican Party is.
I love how, like, he used a black woman. Well, I didn't love that. He used a black woman as a prop to prove that Trump is not racist, because he has a black person working for him. And Rashida Tlaib just pretty much laid the fucking wood on him on that.
Right. Right.
But even then,
like, the media is incapable of really understanding what Rashida Tlaib was saying. I mean, there's some good left media out there that's been good on this, but it wasn't, look, because you've got the woman who Meadows brought up. I'm just spacing her name right now, but she came up and she's basically said, since I said eyebrows up there, willingness, like, Trump is not a racist, I think he's blah blah, and she's defending it. Like, but that wasn't the issue. That wasn't that he brought her up there unwillingly, right? It's the idea that the way that you kind of understand what racism is, right? You combat as racism.
I went back to my house and I found one of these, like, people working on the ranch, and I said, like, they vouch for me.
Well, but it's
slave owner, like, plantation mentality that, like, this is like.
But that's what I'm saying. It's like, even if she is like a fervent Trump supporter and she's there 100% willingly and she even offered to come, the idea that that's what you would do is you'd be on the dais. You'd have an African-American woman come and stand there so you can point to her.
Old white men.
Holy crap.
There's no women on that committee from the Republican side, right?
It's pretty pasty, man. Oh, no. There was
there's one.
There's
Fox,
one. Yeah.
Whatever her. It's the woman from. But a bunch of, like, old white people, pretty much, who are, like, dead and dying, and you bring this, like, black woman up. Yeah. But, like, Rashida Tlaib was, like, not having any of it. And that was just great. I mean, and it's also, like, calling someone a racist is worse than being a racist.
Crazy, right? Crazy, right?
Calling someone a racist, yep. Being a racist, is worse
Than
that person actually being the racist.
Having the gall to violate the rules and refer to me personally. Oh, Mr. Chairman, I ask you to strike that from the record. Oh, God. Oh, that's
also,
that's
I want to add a tweet to the record from D's Nuts 069. Like.
Yes, exactly. 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 Oh my gosh. Well, that's crazy. So and that you know, you got that going on. And then the flip side of it, like the other, you know, on the other side of the screen is that we see that Trump is kind of hanging out with his boy Kim Jong-un over there in Vietnam.
And he was Kim Jong-un.
Kim Jong-un. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I just can think of, like, Kim Jong-un just sitting there like, I got the best PR out of this thing ever. Do you see the freaking pictures? I'm sitting at a table. I'm kind of pointing like I'm doing stuff with the president. Come out here. Hold firm on this shit.
All this while it's going on, it's like the fucking his fixer is on.
It's just like. I seriously, that morning I pulled in the parking lot at work and I sat there and, like, the news, I just had the news running, and it was like they talked about Cohen's coming up and then you got Kim Jong-un, you know, Trump meeting with Kim Jong-un, and it just kind of like hit me like a wave. I'm like, holy frick, what a crazy, crazy world right now. Like, I mean, we're going to be able to look, all I'm saying to this is that we're going to be able to read awesome books about this when we're old, really old. I mean, I'm already old, but you know what I mean? I was like, there's going to be just like, these are going to be history books about this period in time about, like, and people are going to be like, whoa, I can't believe that.
That's if we still have history books in 50 years.
That's true. That's true enough. True enough. Couple things I want to kind of point to. One is that Pramila Jayapal has dropped a Medicare for All bill that is just freaking awesome. And it's basically it's better than the ones that Bernie Sanders actually has been proposed and by better, like, I'm not saying that Bernie's is bad or something like that one that's been out there that's floating around, but here's what's important about Jayapal's bill. Well, there's several things that are important by it, and, you know, we don't have a ton of time today, so we're not going to be able to walk through all this stuff, but definitely check the link out, like, in the show notes for this one. It's really excellent. But one of the things that's the smartest part about this is that you're going to get to full coverage in 2 years, whereas the Sanders bill wants 4 or 6. I can't remember exactly at this point. The why that's important is because the time frame is put within a Democratic administration, right? Presidential administration, right? So in the Jayapal bill, she's making absolutely sure that this can be done within a time when you actually have control of power and can't be undone by the Republican administration, right? Kind of learning the lessons of what happened with Obamacare for all the crap and problems with that. But basically say the longer you let that go, right, the more opportunity is going to have it taken away. And the flip side of that is that once people have a thing, right, it's extraordinarily difficult for somebody to take that away. Right. So the idea is like, you know, once you actually have people with the experience of being able to have access to medical care and have it, this thing, people are not going to want to let that go. And it's a victory. So that is really huge. The other part that's amazing, if you read this story from The Intercept, it's by Ryan Grimm, has got a great write up on it. And his piece is called Special Interest Behind Representative Pramila Jayapal's Medicare for All Bill Are Not the Usual Suspects, because her quote unquote special interests, right, are doctors, nurses, disability rights activists, public citizen, the Center for Popular Democracy. And it's absolutely incredible. And I want to read this one piece in here. Along with the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities, the main groups involved in drafting the legislation were National Nurses United, a major nurses union that has long been on the forefront of the fight for single payer, Physicians for a National Health Care Program, National Health Program, the Center for Popular Democracy, where Barkin Williams talks about here, Public Citizen and Social Security Works, which represents more than a million progressive seniors who support expanding Medicare coverage that they have for the rest of the population. So, and if you hear some of the stories in this piece from Ryan Grimm about the, especially the folks with disabilities who were saying, we weren't just an afterthought. We actually were part of the process of drafting this. And you could almost hear it in the writing about this one person that they're interviewing, this one guy, this Barkin that they're interviewing, like choking up. Like, he can't believe that they're actually included in the process and being asked how to actually craft this legislation. That alone is huge. So the fact that we're going to have potentially competing Medicare for All bills right now is nothing but good news moving forward. So fantastic. Last thing to check out, too, as well, is that Chicago, they just had elections this past week on Tuesday. And the DSA endorsed five candidates that for the Chicago City Council, and four of the five people won their seats. Two additional people were there, was other progressive. They ousted established Democratic Party machine candidates. And now it looks like they're actually going to have like a, you know, they're going to be able to form a caucus within the city council, which is going to be absolutely huge. What's so important about this in Chicago, right? Because Chicago is probably one of the deepest Democratic Party machines that has all sorts of histories of corruption. Rahm Emanuel, of course, has been, you know, the guy who's been taking Chicago down the road into kind of charterism. But it was also that place where we saw, you know, Chicago's teachers union lead those kind of mass protests and strikes, building connections with the community, right, in order to beat back what the worst proposals for privatizations of public schools and lack of support for teachers. And, you know, what Grimm also points to in this is that I'm sorry, this is a different piece. What's also this article points to from Jacobin is that all of that has been built on the organization that started with a union caucus, right? The union caucus that kind of eventually took over the union, right? Progressive union, rank and file, kind of social movement unionism caucus, right? They took that over and from there kept on building, right? And so you see this in a relatively short period of time, moving from a kind of a more kind of traditional, stodgy business unionism model of teachers union to one of the most progressive teachers unions out there, setting a model and setting a new kind of like, you know, bar for what unionization should look like, right, and what a progressive union should look like, and now seeing that bearing fruit years down the road as more people get to organize, right? The idea is that victories lead to more victories, right? And then that's why you set the bar high. So congratulations, all those folks out there in Chicago. You know, frankly, Sean, as I, you know, I know we got to kind of cut to break pretty soon, but one of the things that's best about what we see here with Chicago example is that you've got organizations like the Chicago DSA, for example, is doing very much very similar to what they're doing out there in Pittsburgh. Right, the DSA out there, and from what I understand, this is also starting to kind of happen in the Lehigh Valley. The DSA chapter there, as they're gaining momentum, is really thinking about, yes, of course, you want to be able to kind of, you know, make comments on national politics and things like this, but really the investment and the work is going into building power at a local level. And that, in my mind, is kind of how movements gain power and strength.
Yeah, well, I'll just be short. I mean, like, one of the biggest criticisms, like, with a lot of friends I have in the Philly DSA is that they want, like, the next meeting, instead of picking endorsing, like, candidates for city council, there's so many, there's three at-large seats that are open, and Philadelphia, there's going to be a lot of organizing to get three really good progressive candidates on there. Helen Gim is going to be one as get reelected, but two other really good women elected and a bunch of other city council seats. The Philly DSA has decided to vote whether they want to endorse Bernie Sanders for the 2020 campaign.
I mean, that's, look, that's...
And, like, they like, the Philly DSA has made the complete, their complete, like, their executive board approach is to completely stay out of local politics, local city issues, and, like, focus on national Medicare for All or, like, the Bernie Sanders campaigns.
Well, look, at least in the Medicare, here's the thing. I would separate out those two things. One, the kind of Medicare for All things, at least that actually has, because they've done excellent work in terms of the door knocking and building and building power and building kind of awareness around Medicare for All stuff in Philly. Like Philadelphia, the Philly DSA were one of where they piloted some of their approach to kind of door knocking and support for Medicare for All. And they did some great work there. But why that's important is, like, yes, it's because, yes, it's a national issue, but you're building this connection locally, right? You're talking
about they're locally. Not doing anything else locally.
Well, that's the problem. I mean, like, look, this, like,
they want to completely stay out of local Philadelphia politics.
That's ridiculous. I mean, that is short-sighted.
They like, their philosophy, from what I've heard, one of the biggest critiques is, like, they see, like, they'd rather work on building a national movement than build local movements and, like, try to build a base locally.
Like, it's a false dichotomy, right? I mean, the thing is, like, how do you build a national movement? You build your power locally. You know what I'm saying?
It's, and you, like, don't have a single issue group too, like, just no. Medicare for All.
No, but I mean, look, it's like, I told you this before, is like, this was always been one of the issues that I've had, problems I've had in left politics, right? And especially activist politics, right? And is that, so many folks, and this is true, right, to liberals and progressives too as well, right across the board, is that there's been such a focus for so long on national politics that we don't even know who's representing us in our city council, right? I mean, it's like, we don't know what's happening and the rules that are being made over our own lives down the street, right? But we know everything about the ins and outs of what's happening in Congress. It's a weird kind of abstraction. And my personal belief is that it has everything to do with how politics got shifted, right? Left politics got shifted with their kind of bastions within kind of like college educated and university situations, right? When you had the divorce with the labor movement and you started thinking about kind of ideas and ideology first, as opposed to building power from below. And this goes back, I mean, there's a long history of this kind of stuff. This was the conflict that a lot of left groups had with Saul Alinsky's group, for example, because Saul Alinsky was all about building power on a local basis. And look, these are not, I never seen these things as kind of as separate. But the thing is, right now, you're talking about the beginning of our presidential campaign, right? I think the less pressing issue right now is whether or not you should endorse Bernie Sanders. Bernie's doing just fine right now. Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, look, and if you actually have any kind of power and authority as a movement, right, you don't do what kind of like Democratic Party operatives have done so long, what kind of traditional labor unions have done so long, is you try to pick your winner out of the gate. No, you wait until you have firm commitments across the board on policies that are going to be important to you and you have an active debate. Right. That comes down the road into the primary. That's my personal opinion. So. But kudos to everybody out there in Chicago. Kudos to I keep on hearing all sorts of great stuff going on out there in Pittsburgh. So kudos to those folks in Pittsburgh and any other chapter, any other organization that is actually kind of building that power locally. I'm so psyched about it. And yes, building power locally does not mean ignoring the national picture. All right. So you get what I'm saying, right? I'm mad as hell and I'm going to take it anymore, but I got to fucking get some groceries right now, right? All right, so this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. And I remind you can become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Just go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. You can become a member for as little as $5 a month. By the way, I want to give a shout out. We've got Dorcas is our new writer that I've got a piece that I'm working on with her right now. So hopefully you're going to see some stuff from our new writers. Hopefully we're going to get some new writers that are coming out of Lehigh Valley right now. That has long been my focus. and that I'm going to put my a lot of my energies there. And Sean is going to find somebody out there in Harrisburg that's willing to write on some stuff too as well. Right, Sean?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
I'll be on that.
That'll happen. Right, that'll happen. Right. All right, so this is Kat Mone, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We will be back right after this.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1912. Nearly 1 million coal miners went on strike in Great Britain. A period of great labor unrest marked the year leading up to the massive walkout from the mines. In 1911, dock workers and railroad workers walked off the job. Overall, workers participated in more than 850 strikes. Even school children, fed up with the disciplinary practice of caning, went out on strike. Mine workers in South Wales joined the wave of strikers, but ultimately their actions were defeated. Undeterred by the setback, the Welsh miners demanded the Miners' Federation of Great Britain to take a vote among all miners on the question of establishing a national minimum wage. Up to that time, miners' pay fluctuated with the uncertainty of the coal markets. The miners resoundingly voted to take on the wage issue. They cast ballots 4-1 in favor of a national strike. Nearly 1 million miners answered the call. Alarmed, the Times declared the strike the greatest catastrophe that has threatened the country since the Spanish Armada. The owners of the White Star Line worried that their new ship, the Titanic, would have to travel at reduced speeds on her maiden voyage due to the coal shortage. They scrambled to find more coal, ultimately taking the supply from other ships to ensure their new luxury liner would meet the advertised speeds. Recognizing the impact of the miners' strike on industry and commerce, the government responded by passing a new law through Parliament, calling for a minimum wage to be set district by district. After 37 days, the strike was ended. Not all of the miners received the wages they had hoped for, but the strike had resoundingly proven the power of organized labor.
Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Like us on Facebook and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. Today we got it on our PA focus, got a bunch of stuff that kind of will some to run through, but I want to kind of talk through some things that Sean's been working on right here. Sean, why don't we kind of start out with that? Let's get to the stuff you were at. You've been looking at this Charter Appeals Board, which has been really interesting. There's been some articles that have come out about this, but you were telling me about this, and I'm like, holy crap, this is insane.
Yes. So there is this board within a Department of Education called the Charter Appeals Board, and it was created when Corbett was in office when the charter schools exploded. And this board specifically designed to overrule local school boards, mainly Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Reading cities, who deny charter schools, who shoot down a charter school application within their own municipalities. So in Pittsburgh, there's this charter school named Catalyst Charter Academy. It was shot down by the Pittsburgh School Board unanimously. They filed an appeal their application getting shot down by the school board. It goes in front of this board called the Charter Appeals Board in Harrisburg, and they voted 3-2 to grant the appeal and overrule the local authority. Mm-hmm. So now this charter school is opening up, and it's still ran by Tom Corbett appointee. So we're partying like it's 2011.
This is crazy. I mean,
so like, yeah.
So I get this straight. So this the purpose of the board, right, is basically what it sounds like to me. Tell me if I'm getting this wrong. What it sounds like to me is that the purpose of this board is to make sure
take up grievances that charter schools have with local school boards, or if like their applications get denied, and then take that up with the charter appeals board, appeal the decision and the local decision, and have this charter school in place.
That's pretty nuts. And so its purpose is basically to ensure that school boards allow charters.
Well, the state... Well, I don't know if it's like for the school board to mandate to allow charters, but it's an avenue for the school board. No, it's an avenue for the charters to overrule the school boards after they've been denied and not welcomed in the community.
Right. So, I mean, I'm not saying it's not guaranteed, but it sounds to me as like this is like the stick on the other end. So instead of basically having like a rule that basically says every school board is required to have charters, right? This is the way that you're able to kind of ensure that there's charter schools get this access outside of the public eye for the most part.
Yeah.
That's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah. I mean, it's – I don't think, like, you're forcing a local municipality to do anything, like, to have charters. Like, say if, like, the School Reform Commission or the Philadelphia School Board shot down this charter school, the charter school then has the right to appeal – and we'll most likely have that appeal overturned, granted, and then they would be implemented by the state because of the people that are still sitting on the board. And the people that are sitting on the board, their terms have expired, but Governor Wolf hasn't done a thing to replace them. So these people are now serving whose terms expired in 2015 are still sitting on this board granting these appeals to these charter schools because they were all charter school lackeys that corporate pick, pretty much.
So is there any sense, or has the governor even made a sentence, is there any sense about why these people are still serving on this board?
No. From like, so WHYY had a piece that came from the Notebook, Philadelphia blog. So basically, So this is all like the response was about this issue, right? Politics in Harrisburg. It's under Politics in Harrisburg. Quote, the current members of the Charter Appeal Board continue to serve and carry out their responsibilities. The governor expects to nominate members to the board in the near future. That's it. Like the governor, it seems like this. The governor has either neglected this, has not really cared about this or paid attention to this, or like they don't want to get involved in the politics of having to put these people through the Senate and having to face off with Republicans in a fight through the Senate to get these nominations approved. They would just rather have these terms lapse and have these Corbett holdouts do that than going through the fight of having this done in the Senate, getting these people approved and having an actual charter school friendly board.
That's crazy. I mean, there's
an actual public school, pro public education, traditional public school favored board that would look at these in a more defined eye.
It's crazy. It's interesting. I mean, the Notebook had a, you know, as you were saying, the Notebook had a really great write up on the board. But, and there's a piece of Donna Cooper, right, who is Secretary of Policy for Governor Rendell, and she's now the Director of Public Citizens for Children and Youth. It's an advocacy group. And basically in the Notebook piece, she says, and by the way, Donna Cooper, if you don't know her stuff, you don't live, she's freaking awesome. But they said, quote, why are these people still in place, right? And you know, you get this kind of suggestion that it's because the Senate is controlled by Republicans. And she says, they quote, they do have to negotiate with the Senate, but that isn't a reason to avoid making appointments. That's a reason to find pathways to get it done, she said. Typically, appointments that require Senate confirmation are not just traded with a board or committee, but through the whole state. Like, in other words, the governor could get GOP senators' votes for his cab appointments by offering unrelated appointments or patronage and jobs in exchange. And they always want to trade more generously for paid positions, Cooper said. This is not a paid position. They may have a hearing examiner, a generous salary who hears workers' comp, so blah, blah, blah. So you think those negotiations should have started when Wolf entered office, according to Cooper, but they didn't happen. And the other thing that's disturbing is that this board, right, it's all but one member of the board has ties to the state's charter school sector. And so it's like not only is – so that makes it even more favorable, which you'd expect under Corbett, right? Because Corbett really was pushing this hard. And so you have like
– So you have these relics from the Corbett administration whose terms have expired in 2015. They're still sitting on this board. And at the board meeting the other day on Tuesday, literally only lasted 10 minutes. They gaveled in. They took roll call. Pedro Rivera was the only one there. None of the other board members were there. Everyone phoned in. And, like, there was no discussion on this. Rivera spoke against this, and, you know, there was issues with this charter school, especially using outdated I am voting against this, mainly because of issues with students who need IEDs. And basically, like, the philosophy of this charter school, the representative said last month, oh, we'll just handle them as they happen. And IEDs are special education trainings that, like, so, like, they're neglecting special education stuff. And basically they, like, he said, yeah, no. Like, he's like, I wasn't here last week, but I've read transcripts a few times. And there's a troubling instance where, like, yeah, we'll just handle this as they come instead of having a plan for IEDs and special education in place. And Rivera's like, no, because if that happens, if a charter school defaults on this, on having these, that money gets – that lawsuit then gets forced upon the state, and we have to waste resources in their neglecting of these students. Because the cost of that then gets pushed on upon the school district and the state, because we have to step in and settle this for them.
That's crazy.
And there was no discussion at all. The one person who voted against it, Yaninelli, whatever, he voted against it. He had a question, and that was it. And no one else said anything, and the vote was over within 5 minutes. And they gaveled out.
Wow. I was just checking out this article, too, as well. It's like, in this just blew my mind, right?
I know. This is clearly neglection from the Wolf camp, the Wolf administration.
Well, absolutely. Even like this, the board – so the board is responsible for – this is, again, from the piece from the notebook. Is responsible for interpreting the state's charter school law, and because most members are not lawyers, they rely on their legal counsel to help interpret the law. The current counsel, Elena Koltash, was hired by Corbett's Department of Education in 2011. Right. So even the lawyer who's giving counsel, and there's in this piece too as well, they've got Susan DeJarnett, who's a professor of legal research at Temple, she's brought in to kind of say, look, part of the problem here is that there has been a common sense interpretation of what the charter law says, is that you cannot, like, say no to charters for financial considerations. But then she says, like, there's nothing in the charter law that says that that's the case.
Yeah. Right?
And it's been based upon legal interpretations by people like Elena Koltash. Right.
And Governor Wolf has not done anything to replace these people. I've kept them in office since, like, he's started his term, 2015. And I mean, like, yeah, I mean, and these are the trade-offs that should have happened. Yes, these people will get patronage jobs within the department or within state government or with, like, yeah, I mean, like, that's just the politicking that has to go on there. But they should have done that. Like, this isn't, like, tit for tat, like, legislative priorities within the administration, within the legislature, right? Like, this isn't going to hold up legislation from getting done. I mean, you can get these people, if like what Donald Cooper says, like, these are, you know, get these people patronage jobs somewhere, then it should have been done.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just
it
like
should have been done 4 years ago.
Like she said, I mean, like, what she was basically laying bare is basically, look, here's the raw kind of, like, you know, pull the nice colors off, look at politics, right? So, yes, it's true that if you have the Senate Republicans control, you know, this is state Senate, control that, so you have to actually deal with them, and they're not just going to prove it all here, so you have to kind of, like, wheel and deal, right, in order to kind of, like, make the negotiations, and that didn't happen. And, you know, this is surprising. I mean, I don't know. I think that there's been a growing, I would say, you know, a growing frustration with the Wolf administration on this score, and especially when you're talking about the fact that this is something he campaigned on, right, about supporting public education, and to find out that this kind of apparatus has been neglected and hasn't even been dealt with is striking to me, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's something your, like, secretary has to go to every month. I mean, your education secretary goes there.
Right.
I mean, it's part of his job.
Right.
So, yeah.
So it's not, I mean, you know, Wolf can't even say, well, we didn't know this was going on. Right. So,
yeah.
Oh, man. Well, that's going to be definitely a story that should be followed. And we'll have the link down there to the The notebook piece, which is pretty awesome there. A couple things here. One thing definitely to pay attention to, right, and amazing opportunities for solidarity, right, especially those folks out in the western part of the state. You got 1,700 workers are on strike in Erie, PA, at kind of the Wabeck plant there. And this is kind of really important if you're kind of – this has been a pillar institution in the community, right, where, you know, seriously, you got generations of people who have worked at this plant. It's skilled labor, right? It's, you know, living wage, benefits, union positions, right? And, you know, people have their whole families working for this here. And it's becoming very quickly a story of what has happened to American industry and the ways that these kind of the deference that is paid to kind of corporate entities to basically do whatever the hell they want to workers on the grounds that they can't afford anything. Meanwhile, you find out that that Wabeck and this plant is like, you know, this is a kind of multi-billion dollars of profit, right, that this company makes. This is not, they're not making these choices because the company is hurting. They're making these choices because they want to extract more profit from these workers in order to pay CEOs and investors. That's the problem. Right. So this is one to pay attention to. And our brothers and sisters out there in Western PA, we I know already there's some folks up at Edinburgh University that are part of ABSCUF, my faculty union, that have been kind of organizing to kind of show support and solidarity with those workers there. You know, if people are out there and on the ground, go out there into the work site and things like this, you know, please send us some information our way. You want to write up what's happening there on the ground. I've got articles you want to publish here in Raging Chicken. If you want to kind of come on, we'll do a special show about what's happening on there for Out to Coop podcast. I'd love to do what we can here to lend our voice to those struggles of those workers who are kind of really fighting not just for their jobs, but they're fighting to maintain their community. So this is one to pay attention to, folks. Other things too, I mentioned this about big pharma, big greed. I'm just going to point you to this article, because this article, it's astonishing, right? It's like, this is a great profile in, I think it's Penn Live. Yep. Of this woman, her name is, Ginny Boynton. She lives in Mechanicsburg, right? She's long taken this drug called DAP. She has this rare neuromuscular disease, right? So basically, she literally can't control her muscles. And the thing is that this disease, as reading this article and reading some background on it, what happens in this disease is that you can't control your muscles to the point where you can't control your breath sometimes, right? So you can die from this. And there's a drug, the short story is there's this drug, I'm forgetting what it's called. But there's this drug that's produced by this, was produced for a long time by this drug company, kind of a family run drug company called Jacobus Pharmaceutics, in New Jersey. And they've been producing this drug for 20 years. The thing is that this neurological condition that she suffers from, there's not very many people that have it. It's fairly rare. Right. And so basically what that means is that this drug company did all this research, but they realized that, okay, look, there's not going to be a huge amount of profit in this, right? There's not going to be a huge amount of profit in this. So they chose not to go and seek this particular kind of, what do you call it? FDA approval to have this kind of sold in mass market and stuff, like, simply because it was not worth it. But the way that, because they had done this research on, they find that actually, okay, it still works. So what they were doing is basically writing it off, still producing the drugs and providing it for free for these patients, because they had a medical breakthrough. Right. They had a drug that worked in order to solve this. They knew that it was didn't make sense to try to make this a profit center of the business. But they said, look, this is kind of what we do. We want to solve these things. So we're going to figure this out. Another company comes along. Right.
Buys them out.
Well, they didn't buy them out. What they did, this is what was crazy about it. Right. What they did, this other company comes in and they realize that, hey, look, there's a great opportunity to make some money here, right? This drug called BioMarin Pharmaceutical. And what they did is they took the drug, they basically re-engineered it, and they changed something very small in it, like the capsule or something like this. And they fast-tracked to try to get FDA approval for this drug, right? And then what that meant is that as soon as they got this approval, they would get exclusive rights to sell that drug. Which means the company that pioneered it, that did the research to make it available, would no longer be able to provide it for free without breaking the law, right, and be the subject of lawsuits. So, but when they found out that this was happening, right, that BioMarin Pharmaceutical was actually trying to do this, they tried to kind of, but it was too late. And so now this BioMarin Pharmaceutical has gained the rights, exclusive rights to sell it, and they're going to do it. And they said they're going to price it at $375,000 a year. And so this woman, right, is just one, right? This is just one, right? But this woman, Ginny Boynton, has no idea how the hell she's going to come up with that kind of money, right? At this point, the health insurance companies are not going to pay for it, right? And even if they were to pay 50% of the drug, right, that's still, you know, $175,000 a year, almost $200,000 a year. I mean, that's crazy.
It kind of makes that whole liberal narrative to having access.
Yes.
To good medicine, complete bullshit.
Exactly. Well, and this puts it in kind of stark relief, right? So sure, Ginny Boynton will have access to that drug if she can pony up the money in order to pay for it. Anytime, this should be a rule of thumb, like freaking tattoo it on your hand if you have to, is that anytime in the Democratic primary, for president, the presidential primary, anytime you hear a Democratic Party candidate say about access to quality health care, like they should not be trusted, right? They should have health care, right? They should have it. It's not just access. Right. And if somebody says access, that has to have 2, 3, 4 follow up conversations about what that actually means, because you have the people that, you know, the kind of like the Obama people, the kind of the centrists in the Democratic Party. Access means they need to be able to buy into some sort of marketplace as opposed to providing this for everybody. It's not health care for all. It is not Medicare for all. So. That was just a devastating story that I just wanted to highlight, because it was just, you know, and there has been some congressional hearings on this. Bernie Sanders has weighed into this and basically said what you'd imagine he would say, that this is freaking disgusting. And Elijah Cummings even made reference to this in the Cohen hearing about it. So give that a read, just so you get your head around what's at stake in this next election. Last thing I just wanted to mention, this was kind of an interesting note, this was in my morning coffee, Sean. That's how I got this. Yeah, it was in my morning coffee. There's a new publication that is out there in the Harrisburg area.
Right?
It's called
the Capital Star.
What's that?
Capital Star.
It's called the Pennsylvania Capital Star, and there's this slick, dapper young gentleman by the name of John Misick, who writes a piece called Morning Coffee. He used to do this when he was, you know, with Penn Live too as well. I'm just playing around. But in today's one, it was actually a kind of a cool piece. Check it out. He talks about, once you get past the whole fellow seekers thing, Senator Vincent Hughes he's a ranking Democrat on the Senate Appropriations Committee in the state. And basically what he wants to do is he wants to take a data-driven approach to public policy to ensure that lawmakers are fully informed about the potential impacts of legislation on people living in poverty before they vote. Right. One of the most consequential parts of this, in my mind, is this proposal that would require the state's independent fiscal office to crunch the governor's annual general fund budget proposal and the final enacted product to determine its poverty impacts. Right. So in other words, now, again, this is a political leveraging tool. Right?
It's also the same budget that Wolf is using to go raiding some funds.
Well, exactly. Right. Exactly. So what it would basically do is that it would expose this, right, to say, well, how is this going to impact the most vulnerable? And ironically, this follows up basically on the example of what they do out in Utah, right? They do a similar kind of stuff. So it's kind of an interesting idea to see what happens about and how Hughes may use this. So just kind of stick a pin in that one, everybody, to see what happens with Hughes's legislation. He's also got some good, you know, some stuff coming up. There's going to be some rallies that are going to be happening in Harrisburg fairly quickly or fairly soon about the kind of free college tuition, right? The PA promise. We'll see what happens with that. Things have been fairly quiet on that front, like legislatively speaking, which is there's a big rollout and seems to have not been front and center in a lot of what's been being pushed, at least on the floor out there, and it's been in the paper. So we're going to see another push before the end of the school year to really push on this PA promise too as well. So Vincent Hughes looks like he's going to be pretty busy in the coming up here. So look at the stuff on the poverty and see how this may kind of in the end impact and be used potentially for really positive political uses to put pressure upon certain kinds of budget proposals that would negatively impact the poor. So check that out. Anything else going on around the state, Sean?
No, I think it's pretty much it.
All right. Well, hey, Sean has got stuff to do. He's got like laundry and things to do today. So We're running late to begin with. My kids had a 2-hour delay today, so we got started much later than we normally did, and it's thrown me out of whack, thrown Sean out of whack. I got a dentist appointment this afternoon too as well, so it's a much stuff here. Yes, that's right. I actually have dental insurance. You know why, folks? Because I got a union, right? So unionize, Medicare for all. That's where we're going to go. All right, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We will be back right after this short break. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. For the past 7 years, Raging Chicken Press has brought pull-no-punches, progressive reporting, and commentary to the interwebs. Our long-form investigative pieces, stories that no access journalist wants to touch, or rollicking weekly podcasts strive to advance progressive movements and perspectives rooted in the struggles happening across the country or down the street. We've broken national stories and caused our share of discomfort in the halls of power. If we want a progressive future, we need progressive media. And you can help support Pull No Punches, homegrown progressive media today. Become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. We need to make sure to keep the movement in the media and the media in the movement. Best way you can do that is to become a member of Raging Chicken today by going to patreon.com/rcpress. Thank you for your energy, your encouragement, and your support. Keep up the fight. We don't really have any Space Force news today, but I just love that song. Space Force. But since there looks like there is a kind of this rebirth. Now, I just want to lay out the ground for today's last call and our space news. I say just to review. Right. I'll lay out two things on the table. Right. Why we do this. Right. Number one is just I just geek out about space stuff and I need a place to talk to about it. Right. And I totally recognize that I'm totally geeked out on it. But secondly is that you've got major moves of what's actually happening in terms of the expansion of expansionist kind of capitalism, which we can call kind of galactic capitalism, which is where things are going and the kind of money and investments in long-term stuff that is being put into the privatization of outer space is just striking to me. And if we think that we've created the first, like, trillionaires or whatever, like, right now, wait to see what's going to happen down the road, right? I mean, some of us are going to be dead and gone by that time. But down the road, when people get access to kind of mineral rights and things like this, to asteroids and interplanetary bodies that they're going to be able to hold the rest of us here on humble planet Earth hostage, just like they always have. So that's the kind of the idea, right? So the idea is that we need to pay attention to stuff because there's actually things that are happening, and we're finding out that there's all sorts of initiatives that are happening under here, and Mike Pence, the current vice president, is a huge proponent of all this stuff. So anyways, there you go. And here's the perfect example of this. So following up in the whole public-private partnership world of things, one of the things that the Obama administration did as one of the things I think I was probably most pissed off at just in kind of like a visceral level was when they put an end to the space shuttle program. Right. So that this was a kind of a NASA program and you had the space shuttle that was produced. Right. I mean, all the wonder that came out of that and actually what it actually did. Right. How it was a reusable aircraft. I mean, a spacecraft, how it was, became so much part of our culture and so much part of what NASA did and our access to space. And the Obama administration decided that they were going to close it down. And they were going to shut it down, not just because it was old, right? Because you can build new ones, right? The next version of the space shuttle. But they made a decision to turn over space exploration to private entities, right? Now, of course, the barrier to entry, right, to a space program, right, to become competitive in a space market is like you already have to have like billions of dollars in the bank, right, because this is such an incredibly expensive industry to deal with. So that's where you go. So you've already stacked the deck, right, and you're already basically putting organizations like Boeing, Northrop Grumman, and the other military contractors, right, in kind of like, you know, the fast lane, pole position to kind of like take advantage of this and profit off this kind of privatization of space. And what that ultimately means is that our money, right, our money, American taxpayer money, is being directed to subsidize these multi-billion-dollar corporations, right, in order to do this. Instead of doing this ourselves, we're doing it to profit centers for for-profit companies. And that includes the kind of like the nifty Silicon Valley ones like SpaceX, right, to the kind of more entrenched kind of military contractors of things like Boeing, right? So anyways, that was part of the big news of what's happening this week is that for a while now, we've basically had any astronauts we send up, American astronauts or Canadian astronauts for that matter, that are going to be sent up to the International Space Station, they have to be launched from Kazakhstan, right, and rely on the Soyuz rockets, right, because that's the only other place, the only way to get humans up to the International Space Station at this point. SpaceX has been in competition with Boeing primarily to develop a crew spacecraft, right? So that actually we can start sending astronauts to the International Space Station and eventually in terms of some of these the aspirational programs like a kind of a moon base and kind of a moon space station, which we'll talk about in the next segment here. But tomorrow, it looks like they're going to finally test the Crew Dragon. And if it's a successful test, they're going to do some additional tests. And by the summertime, they're actually going to do crewed tests of this, right? We're actually with people in them and sending them up to kind of low orbit and kind of bring them back down to see if this works. So this is going to be one of these steps forward. Like this happens incrementally, but there you go. Boeing was initially supposed to happen in March. They were going to test their crew capsule. But that's got pushed out to April, and this is pretty common in how that happens. So keep an eye on that. I'll certainly be keeping an eye on that and see where this goes from here. I really want to find a way to get some access to kind of what are these contracts worth, right? To see like how much money is actually being put in this stuff. I just haven't done my homework enough yet. Second thing is Canada joined up with NASA to support the Lunar Gateway project. Right, so there's basically this quote-unquote Lunar Orbital Platform Gateway Program. That's what it's called. It's basically going to be like the International Space Station, except it's going to orbit the moon. And the long-term thinking on this is that, you know, if you want to make kind of interplanetary travel even partially affordable, you have to be able to launch from someplace like the moon, right, or orbit, right, simply because it's too costly to actually get out of the gravity well of the Earth before you can go to Mars. But once you actually have some sort of infrastructure built up on the moon or orbiting the moon to kind of launch directly from there, then you're actually bringing the cost way down, right? So that's kind of part of their goal and their thinking here, in addition to a whole bunch of kind of scientific research. We should also, last week on the show, we talked about, because what's happening in China. China has actually had its first ever lander they put up there on the dark side of the moon, and they are kind of moving forward to kind of putting people on the moon and actually thinking about moon bases there too as well. So within our lifetime, folks, this is actually going to be a reality, right? This infrastructure program, this kind of extraplanetary infrastructure program, is going to accelerate. So that's my update. Good old space for the day. So just another beer news, right? Kind of run through this quick. On Sunday, looks like going to be a really cool event happening at Free Will Brewing. It's going to happen just at their main brewery in Perkasie, the Spirit of Mardi Gras. They are going to have basically a barrel age celebration, a barrel age tap takeover. And I was going to read you through what they're actually going to have there. They're going to have all the taps are going to be barrel aged stuff. They're going to have the 2015 Ralphius. They're going to have the 2016 Ralphius, 2017 Ralphius, the coconut chocolate Ralphius, which is, by the way, freaking awesome. That was great. They're going to have the coffee Ralphius, right? The 2017 Ella, the maple Ella, the maple Tuku, right? Which is phenomenal, by the way. That one's awesome, too. The Apple Brandy Barrel Age Wee Heavy, right? Which is a Scottish ale. There's a barrel age, some kind of potion, and brown beard. Right. So most of these are going to be fairly small pours because they're pretty heavy. Right. Like upwards of 14% ABV. But that's going to be cool. It's going to be their pre-Mardi Gras celebration. There's going to be traditional New Orleans food being provided by Down to Earth Cafe, which will be a lot of fun. Also tomorrow on Saturday. So that the Spirit of Mardi Gras is on Sunday. On Saturday, there's going to be a double can release, one just in time for St. Paddy's Day. You've got the 7-course red, which is traditional Irish red. It's a great beer, right? It's got a really solid red ale. I personally like it a lot, right? It's not the kind of thing that's going to knock your socks off as like this really special kind of beer. It's just a really good beer. And then they have a new beer called Fresh King Cake. Right. And that is another one. This is the second one we've had like this, I think, Sean, a no boil one, which I'm still I got to get over there and talk to some of the folks there just to find out what that actually that entails and why.
I heard they don't boil it.
Huh? Well, yeah, duh. I'm not that dumb. I just look it.
Last words.
Yeah. Well, fair enough. But it looks interesting. So this one is it's a no boil white ale. And it's brewed with 120 pounds of fresh ground pecans, orange, cinnamon, and vanilla. And it's a 7% ABV. And I'll give you their description of it so you can decide if it's something you're interested in. So it says, quote, after many deliberations on how to approach Mardi Gras-inspired beer for this weekend's festivities, we decided the most appropriate would be a liquid interpretation of the city's carnival staple. We're quite pleased with the result and are excited to debut it in cans and on draft in both tap rooms this Saturday. Rest assured, we made plenty to last through our barrel age celebration the following days. Hope to see you there. So it is kind of marketed specifically for Mardi Gras. It's got a really cool, colorful Mardi Gras-inspired can. Go pick some up if you can, if you're interested in doing that. I have to say, I did, after just to report back, last week, I did go get the Chasing the Dragon, and I did get the... I'm spacing the name of it. Why am I spacing the name of it? It's my favorite beer that they produce.
Oh, the mango habanero.
Yeah. Why am I spacing the name of it? This is horrible.
Safe word.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I can't believe it. But I was not disappointed, right? It was so good. It is so good. And I had, like, you know, Chasing the Dragon. I had Safe Word because, like, I used to really, really like Chasing the Dragon. I still do. But I'm definitely, yep, I wanted to test it next to the Safe Word, and Safe Word is still my fave. And I brought some of this over. I went to last weekend too, as well as Saturday night. My neighbor has a Burns Fest every year, right? He's a Scottish guy. And so I brought over some samples of that and had some good beer conversation over there too, as well. So, in addition to some really nice Scottish whiskey. So,
I had some Sunny Side Up this week.
Sunny Side Up, where do you get that from, Sean?
Pizza Boy.
Oh! Now Sean is becoming a regular now at Pizza Boy after he's kind of broke the seal, so to speak, and going back there after his departure, shall we say. Yeah, and how was the Sunny Side Up?
Really good.
Yeah. Really good. That's awesome. Sounds like a
just
fun.
As I remembered it.
Just as you remembered it. Did you go, like, did you grab food there, too, as well? Or did you go grab for a beer? What'd you do?
Just a couple beers and a six-pack.
Yeah, a couple beers and a six-pack.
Yeah. And then pay off my credit card.
Whoa! Big news. Big news.
Yeah. So you all those textbooks from college that are now useless, I've finally been paid off.
There you go, man. That's a big deal. That's a real big deal. Right?
Yeah, I mean... I still got like a couple $100 left on it, but did my taxes this past week, was able to save more money than I needed to pay my taxes, and then...
Did you see the big kickback from the Trump tax break?
I and I actually had to pay this year. I did not see anything. But the money that was left over from my taxes that I saved up for, I was able to pay off my credit card with. And yeah, no, I... Well, there's still like a $200 balance on there that I'm going to pay off next month. But no, for the most part, I took a huge chunk of my credit card down. It's pretty much paid off for the first time since like getting it, before college and everything. And it's a good feeling.
Yeah,
it's like, gotta be, man. It's like the stuff millennials have to deal with that are like milestones that everyone else is like sort of like normal for.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, man, congratulations. Congratulations. And now you can get back into taking beautiful pictures of birds on the Susquehanna, right?
Yep. That's what I plan on doing.
Very cool,
I'm
man.
I'm going to be getting my 70 to 200 2.8 lens from Canon used. And since they came out with an updated version, the prices on the previous version have been dropping. They dropped about like $400 or $500 mm-hmm. a lens, which is pretty good considering it's like a $1,200. It was like $1,500-$1,600 for a used version of the lens I'm looking at. Now they're down like $1,100 to $1,200,
pretty
which
awesome.
which is a good drop.
Yeah, I'll say. I'll say.
Yeah. So it makes that a bit more affordable. And
especially when you got no credit card debt.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're just gonna, you know, ramp that back up. So.
Now, my goal is to put the credit card, put a lens on the card, pay it off over a few months, and get a second lens. There's two lenses I really want to get, and then start doing my research on getting a professional camera body within the next year.
There you have it, man.
Yeah.
Big news. Big news.
Yeah, invest in stuff that could bring me more money down the line.
Yeah, because Sean's all about the greenbacks, man.
Especially now. I've become a dirty capitalist.
He is. Freaking dirty capitalist. He watches what he says in polite company now. Oh, my God. I don't know if I would like to say that because I might disrupt the genuinely wonderful feeling of this event. Just playing with you. Oh, man. So you got any plans?
I am militantly keeping my receipts this year's. And
good for you.
Documenting them. And we'll be definitely trying to take advantage of the tax code next year once tax season comes around and write-offs and stuff like that.
Yeah, there you go. Go. Are you going to establish your own pass-through organization?
Yeah, my name is the Trump Organization.
Yeah.
Kitchen Organization.
Yeah, there you go.
The Recoverable Trust.
The Recoverable Trust. Wouldn't it be funny to set up a bunch of pass-through organizations that were all kind of like variations on like Trump themes? Right? just to like, you know, and then figure out what you're going to do with them later. But just to kind of say, my pass-through organization, right? And it would all be like turn their names into verbs, right? Ivanka'd. I got Jared'd. Kim Jong-un. I don't know. Whatever. Cool. All right. Well, cool. You got any plans for the weekend other than hoping it doesn't snow?
Yeah. Other things.
Other things. Good. Good for you. Laundry, yeah. Stuff. You know.
Some recreational fun.
Some recreational fun. Yeah. Sean, I gave Sean a new bike. My kid grew out of his bike, so Sean doesn't have his bike anymore. So I'm going to give him my kid's bike so he can ride around the thing. Right? That's what you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Oh, something like man. That.
Yeah. I'm going to be doing... I have to say I've been inspired by... I don't know if you saw the pictures or not, but I did the rearrange of the studio space. Well, you can actually see it right now for a little bit from as we're talking, but we've been doing just major kind of getting rid of stuff. We were talking about this beforehand, too. Like, you know, just going through and just getting rid of just papers that have been around for ages. That had to be saved for some reason at some point, but you know, true spring cleaning. Right? I think I'm ready for spring. Crazy. All right, man. Well, anything else for the good of the order?
That's it.
All right. Well, hey, thank you all for sticking with us. And keep us in mind if you're looking for an outlet, if you're frustrated and you need something, a place to say it. Well, you know, consider Raging Chicken Press. You know, drop me an email, ragingchickenpress@gmail.com, and we can talk about how get you started. Right, in true activist media, keeping the media in the movement in the media. I remind everybody you can support what we do here in this podcast and what we do in the pages of Raging Chicken by becoming a member by going to patreon.com/rcpress today. You become a member for as little as $5 a month. Seriously, it's like a beer, man. It's like, I mean, a decent beer, but it's a beer, right? A month to become a member. Thanks, y'all, for tuning in and listening. We will be back once again next week. As the world burns. Here we go.
See ya!
Given my experience working for Mr. Trump, I fear that if he loses the election in 2020, that there will never be a peaceful transition of power. And this is why I agreed to appear before you today.